Trump and the Republicans are so upset about the fact that Biden has stepped down and they won't be running against him, that they want to sue the Democratic Party for not nominating Biden. They're looking into where they can sue, which is kind of hilarious. But
I recommend Eileen Cannon for that
one. Yeah, yeah, well, exactly. Welcome to Beg to Differ, the Bulwark's weekly roundtable discussion featuring civil conversation across the political spectrum. We range from center left to center right. I'm Mona Charon, syndicated columnist and policy editor at the Bulwark, and I'm joined by our regulars, Bill Galston of the Brookings Institution and the Wall Street Journal, Damon Linker, who writes the Substack newsletter Notes from the Middle Ground, and Linda Chavez of the Niskanen Center. Our special guest this week is University of Illinois professor Nick Grossman, author most recently of Drones and Terrorism, Asymmetric Warfare, and the Threat to Global Security. Welcome, one and all. Not much to talk about this week. all right. So last night, President Biden gave his Oval Office address explaining his decision to step down and framing it as an act of patriotism, and that he put country over personal ambition. And I think we can all agree that that has dramatic, whether we agree with his explanation or not, we can agree that everything is different now. I mean, the world has transformed, seem really overnight. Nicholas Grossman, I'm going to start with you. The party solidified unbelievably rapidly around Kamala Harris. My theory is that because Biden's departure was so wrenching and so protracted, the party just did not have any appetite left for another fight. And they were just saying, let's just unite. We'll go with Harris. This is it. No arguments. What do you think? Or was it her? Did she sort of grease the skids, or a little of both? Or
there's probably some of both. That I think you're right with about your general sense of Democrats, that this was such an ugly fight for them, something that they had probably been putting off for a while and then eventually had and spilled over and had a lot of bitter feelings with people launching accusations against each other. So the opportunity to move on, to turn the page, was something they grabbed at. I think also probably that we are seeing Kamala Harris display some better political instincts or acumen than many thought, in that she and her people must have lined up a lot of this stuff behind the scenes. And before that, she was always supportive of Biden in public. She resisted any pressure to seem like she was pushing him out, never actually said something like, he's definitely going all the way to November and everybody has to get in line, or anything along those lines. So I think she handled it pretty deftly. And that also part of what we're seeing is that the vice president is the obvious choice, that not only have we had, say, vice presidents be the nominees after they served in office a bunch, but the whole point of having a vice president is to have a backup if the president can't do the job. And we put vice presidential nominees on presidential tickets. So everybody in 2020 voted for Biden-Harris, and all the primary voters knew that they were getting Biden-Harris. And any primary voter, at least a whole lot of them, probably went into it thinking, well, if Kamala Harris is unacceptable to me, you know, there's a decent chance Joe Biden has to, at minimum, lean on his vice president more over the next 4 years, if not just pass it on directly. And so a lot of it, I think also you're seeing that the natural successor is the one who is able to line up a lot of people. And maybe if there were more time, we would see other ambitious Democrats try to get in the race. But since there's such a small amount of time until Election Day, and since Democrats are so intent on beating Trump, that when she stepped up and then nobody else really had a good opportunity, and so they just did the logical thing of getting behind the number two after the number one stepped down.
Bill, we've talked a lot about Kamala Harris on this podcast, and you know, we've been dubious about her political skills, which, by the way, I think we're probably all going to want to amend right now, because she seems to have really stepped up. But I remember discussing this, and we were saying, you know, that it was a shame that the Democratic Party being the way it is, it would have to be Harris, because otherwise the African American women who are such an important constituency in the Democratic Party would feel passed over and so on. And that couldn't happen. Therefore, it would have to be her. And we sort of regretted that. And, you know, I have a slightly different view of it now in the rearview mirror, which is that they would have been right to feel that they'd been slighted, right? If the party had said, you know, we're going to go to the trouble to depose the sitting president, but not her. You know, I understand why African-American voters would have felt slighted. How do you feel?
A couple of points, Mona. First of all, I took a look at the history going all the way back to the first election after the Second World War. And in every case, including two cases in which the vice president, through death or resignation, had already acceded to the presidency, in every single case, a serious challenge was mounted to the vice president's effort to get the presidential nomination. So the idea that the vice president is the natural heir apparent is not an idea that either political party has, you know, has endorsed and acted upon as long as I've been alive. Secondly, you know, I have some informants inside the DNC, you know, even friends, you know, and when I was an early advocate of an open process, should Biden decide to step down, they told me, Bill, you may be right in theory, but in practice, it's too late. That, you know, if Biden had stood down even 6 months ago, there would have been a genuinely open process with multiple candidates. Yeah. But with a month to go, and, you know, and so one of them told me
before the convention, yeah,
before the convention. And so one of them told me, you know, it's sort of Field of Dreams with the minus sign. We'll build an open process and nobody will come. And that turned out to be exactly correct.
Right. All of her potential rivals immediately endorsed her.
Yeah. They, you know, and that's what, you know, that's what someone I know very well on the inside told me. That was inevitable given the timing. I think it's too early to tell, frankly, you know, whether Harris's political skills will be equal to the task. I absolutely agree with people who are saying that she handled the first 48 or 72 hours impeccably. I also agree with Nick that she handled this awkward interregnum between the presidential debate, which stunningly is less than a month ago, and, you know, and Biden's decision to step down with perfect pitch and very good control, including over her staff. No leaks, no nothing. Mm-hmm. That was good politics. Mm-hmm. But will that work? Will that continue? Things are going to get tougher. Because she's going to come under attack. And as I wrote in my most recent Wall Street Journal column, she has multiple areas of vulnerability that I think Republicans are going to spotlight.
Yeah,
we have some examples, but I'm going to stand down.
We're going to we'll get to that because that's important. But first, I want to talk a little bit more about the launch. Linda, she did that first sort of introduction at the campaign headquarters in Delaware. Beautifully done, I thought. She had tremendous poise, confidence, certain presence that I hadn't necessarily seen from her before. Incredibly impressive. Also, the second gentleman was very winsome too. Her elevation has given rise to something that we couldn't have predicted. Well, I don't know, maybe somebody predicted it, but internet memes, she's kind of a cultural phenomenon all of a sudden. Coconuts are cool. I mean, all of that stuff, really, you can't even put a price on. It's so valuable in politics. It's seeming to happen for her.
Yeah, you know, it's not a surprise to listeners of this program that Kamala was not my first, second, or third choice to be the Democratic nominee. However, I have been really impressed with the job she's done. And I, you know, I think a lot of us looked at her 2019 campaign and said, wow, she really blew that. And as I said before, I was actually someone who thought she might be a really good candidate. And I liked a lot of what she was saying, including the fact that when she was sort of asked that there was a Washington Post profile about her, and she was asked, you know, how do you identify? And I think her response was, as an American, you know, not having to pick her Jamaican Black father over her Indian-born mother as her primary identity. But what was impressive about this was what she was able to do to the base of the Democratic Party. First of all, Black women are the backbone of the Democratic Party. And without the support, the enthusiastic support, the turnout of Black women, Democrats never have a chance. And they were clearly not enthusiastic about Biden. She, in a matter of 24 hours, you know, pulling together her sorority sisters from Howard University. I love the fact she went to Howard University, yep. Which, by the way, you know, for those who haven't, you know, studied African-American history, most of the most impressive minds to come out of the Black community in the last 100 years, many of them have come from Howard University. So she pulled together that network. They started raising money for her. But more importantly, they gathered the troops. Thursday, the day that we're taping this show, she addressed the American Federation of Teachers, my old home. I worked for the AFT for almost 9 years in my youth, and they are extremely important in the Democratic base because they are union members. They are well organized. They put people in the field. They knock doors, man telephone banks, and do all of the sort of necessary work for turnout. So I think that in and of itself has earned her the right to be enthusiastically endorsed by Democrats. Do I agree with her on policy? No. But the thing that irritates me most about the arguments against her is this label that she is the DEI candidate. I am a huge critic of diversity, equity, and inclusion as an ideology. I've written about it. I've talked about it. It is just racist to say that she is the DEI candidate. She has worked her way up in the Democratic ranks, earning political office after political office. And I just think it's really disgusting when people call her that.
Yeah, Damon, I have long been a critic of certain aspects of radical feminism, wrote a whole book about it. But these kinds of attacks bring out the feminist side of me, I have to say. When you see, you know, her being attacked for sleeping her way to the top, which is, you know, circulating on Twitter, and DEI and all of that, you know, standards that are never associated with men. And if we're going to have sexual morality, are we going to do a side-by-side comparison of her with Trump? Well, anyway, I find that deeply offensive. And speaking of that, the Speaker of the House had to ask his caucus to dial down the racial attacks on the vice president. So this has been, in addition to a very inspiriting moment for the Democrats, it's been a tough week for the Republicans. They are, Trump is obviously having really, he's flailing because he can't stand it when somebody else is the object of attention, of any kind of attention. And also he recognizes that the race has been completely upended now, and it's anybody's, it's a jump ball. Whereas he was heading for victory before Sunday and Biden's decision?
Yeah, I mean, certainly the Republicans are behaving ridiculously, but, you know, it's not just backbenchers in the House. It's, I mean, I don't know that J.D. Vance has said all that much about Harris yet, but, I mean, he's been embroiled in all kinds of controversies all week long because he just won't shut up. As someone said on Twitter a few days ago, it's a bad idea to pick the guy who at the party will say, now you're not going to like what I'm going to say, but I'll tell you. And he's that guy. Yes. There's a clip of him saying everything and anything, you know, talking to total right-wing loons like Curtis Yarvin and Tucker Carlson interviews where Vance just loves to kind of spin out, you know, really insulting attacks on like all women who don't have children, you know, stuff like that. I mean, maybe we'll get to that later in the show, but, you know, that's been quite something. And it does contrast, I think, very darkly compared to all the positive energy coming from the Democrats this week, because they really are giddy at how well things are going and just liking Harris. Now, my view, I'm not a swooner, and even if I were tempted to want to reevaluate my assessment of Kamala Harris on the basis of the last 5 days, I would refrain from doing so for fear that I was speaking from a kind of emotional outburst from being happy that Biden is no longer the nominee, because I, as everyone knows, I've been worrying about this for almost a year now, and I'm hugely relieved that things have turned out this way. On the other hand, I think when the dust settles after a few weeks, and it's going to be murky for a while because we also have then the DNC coming up in like 3 weeks. And so there's, you know, you would expect there'd be a bit of a bump from that. So the polls until probably will probably settle out into a kind of new normal first, second week of August. Then there'll be the DNC and they'll be shaken up again. It really won't be until early September that we can really gauge a new head-to-head norm in the tracking polls. My guess is that since the debate, I mean, Biden had been behind a little bit at the national level all along. And since the debate, he really started to sink. Not immediately. It wasn't like a an airplane pointed at the ground, but he was sagging both nationally and in the swing states on a very bad trajectory. That thankfully instantly got wiped away once Harris became the new nominee. And if I had to guess, I would say probably the new normal will be close to a tie with Harris, probably slightly behind, which is where Biden was about 2 months ago, slightly behind, but within the margin of error. That doesn't mean Harris can't jump ahead and actually make a difference, but I am convinced this is going to be a nail biter. And I thought it would be a nail biter all through until the debate, when I thought, oh, geez, Trump's actually going to walk away with this thing. This could be a landslide. And that's what's leading Trump to kind of freak out this week and be more like the old fellow we all remember so well. Because he's now in panic mode that, wait a minute, first of all, I picked this guy to be my Veep and he looks like he's going to be a lead bull. He's going to be a dead weight around my ankles. And secondly, now I'm not running against the old guy who can't form a sentence. Now I'm running against this young, charismatic, attractive, articulate candidate on the other side. But in the end, I don't think it's going to blow things wide open. I don't think we're going to see Kamala Harris up 4 points a month from now. I think it's going to kind of remain a hairline difference between the two. And the outcome is going to depend on tiny margins in those 7 or so swing states. Again, I think she's done well so far, but I don't see anything that's going to change the dynamic fundamentally. At least that's how I see it so far.
So, Nick, she has some tremendous advantages. She may be able to wipe out the lack of enthusiasm among young voters. We've already seen polling to that effect among African-American voters and minorities in general, women. So she has some real strengths. She also has some definite weaknesses. So let's talk about some of those. First of all, as Biden's vice president, she does carry some of the Biden baggage with her. So specifically, I would say the biggest weaknesses are the border and inflation. Curious, do you agree that those are the big weaknesses, at least as vis-a-vis the Biden record? And how much room does she have to separate herself from the record of the administration of which she was a part?
So I think on those that you're right, that those are probably the biggest drags policy-wise on her candidacy, though those would be a drag on any Democrat. And mm-hmm. what I've been thinking about a lot is with the Biden to Harris change. So where I think that Damon is right, that the election is likely to be close. It always was. If anything, this was my objection to a lot of the polling analysis, is that it would be like somebody's up one. Oh, they're totally winning. And then somebody else is up two. Oh, that's it. It's over. And really what all those were telling us is it's going to be close. And, mm-hmm. you know, these have little margin of error and different quirks between them and what have you. So that it was going to be close. And that's something like immigration in particular, the border has been Republicans' number one issue for a while. And that people who are passionate about it are going to vote Republican anyway. I don't know how many swing voters are dancing kind of on the head of that particular pin, in that there are people who are very concerned about the border, but weren't already voting Trump, who thought that Biden was just good enough on the border for that to be okay, but think that Harris is going to be just not good enough, that that's going to decide their vote. I bet there probably aren't a lot of people like that. I'd say similar thing about inflation, of that there's no way to avoid being tied to it, because she is going to be effectively the incumbent party's representative, and any Democrat would have been the incumbent party's representative. Anybody who is taking a look at the economy, which has been trending in positive directions in just about every metric that we have, including good GDP growth numbers that just came in. And if there are people who are still upset about the price increases, which burden a whole lot of people, I mean, very reasonable thing to be upset about. But if they are upset about the administration for that, and they are still deciding their vote based on that, I don't think that that's going to change all that much. She's pretty much tied to it and is in the position to make the case that, look here, all these good things about the economy. We really turned things around via COVID and try to play that incumbent card. The one part where I do think she personally will make a difference, this is more with, say, some of the Democratic base voters than with swing voters, but is on foreign policy, especially on Gaza, in that a lot of the anger from the left against Biden on Gaza seems to be focused very much on Biden specifically, that on him specifically, you know, and with the nickname Genocide Joe, and where even like when I walked around protests that were on my campus, that a lot of it was focused on Biden specifically or Biden by name, and that this had reached a level that was politically dangerous for Democrats, including, say, more than anywhere else in Michigan, in which Biden's margin in 2020 was a little over 100,000. And the number of people who turned out for a protest vote in the Democratic primary was a little over 100,000. And a number of Arab American, Muslim American, some other voters said that it was simply a moral issue, that even if they agree that Trump is really bad or is worse, that they simply can't bring themselves to vote for Biden. And even if Harris's policies towards that are largely the same, that they don't have that same sort of personal dislike and belief that this is a person who is too much in a 20th century conception of Israel instead of 21st century conception. And some of them might find more opportunity to come home. So if I were a Democrat, I would think, if I were, say, a Democratic strategist, I would look at it as, if Harris's biggest points of liability are things that would weigh down on any Democrat, things like immigration or economic issues, whereas the biggest thing that was against Biden specifically, which was age and concerns about his ability to do the job, and then some additional ones personalized with Gaza and a few other issues, that having those off the table are really beneficial. And then having a Republican's biggest attack against a Democratic candidate, he's too old to do the job. And also for that matter, his son is, you know, a crook and an addict, that those are both gone. And Republicans put a lot of weight on that. So about as best, I think, as, you know, a Democrat can deal with. Of course, they have a bunch of issues. But if they're not to her specifically, if they're instead to the Democratic Party and its policies, then that is good territory for them to be in.
Bill Galston, Trump and the Republicans are so upset about the fact that Biden has stepped down and they won't be running against him, that they want to sue the Democratic Party for not nominating Biden. They're looking into where they can sue, which is kind of hilarious. But
I recommend Eileen Cannon for that one.
Yeah, yeah, well, exactly. But, you know, the campaign ads are being churned out, I'm sure, even as we speak. And a number of things will be highlighted about Kamala Harris's past, her past positions. So in 2019, she endorsed the Green New Deal, Medicare for all, and banning fracking. So should she retreat from those positions? Should she emphasize others? I mentioned education as an area where your old boss, Bill Clinton, was able to gain some credibility as a centrist by coming out for school uniforms, for example, signaling that he was sort of more culturally in the center. She could do things like that with some other issues, even if she can't completely escape from certain weaknesses. What do you think?
Well, I'm glad you framed the question in that way, Mona, because so far we've talked about her structural weaknesses within the Biden-Harris administration, right? Both in general and specifically on inflation. But there's a third category of weaknesses having to do with what she said and what she did when she was in California, when she was in the Senate, and when she was running for president the first time. And believe me, the Republicans are going to find, you know, a target-rich environment, as the Air Force would put it. And now that what I'm about to say is out in the open, I can say it without doing Republicans' opposition research for them. I was interested to find out where she stood on the abolish ICE issue, if you can remember that far back. And so I was just nosing around on the internet the way people do, and I found a Senate confirmation hearing when she was a senator in which she specifically compared ICE to the KKK and said Great. That it had to be torn down and rebuilt from scratch. And I said to myself and then to a friend privately, oh my God, I hope the Republican opposition research doesn't find this. 20 hours later, Donald Trump brought it up in a speech.
Yeah.
Now, and do I think that's a one-off? No chance. But let's just stick to one of the points that you made in your setup question, fracking. I've been saying for some time that Pennsylvania is going to earn its moniker this year as the Keystone State. I just paid a visit to a swing county in Pennsylvania last week. Someone who's anti-fracking cannot win the state of Pennsylvania. It's just as simple as that. She can't. Unless she figures out a way, you know, there was a famous story about FDR during his first reelection campaign in 1936. And he was planning to go visit, you know, Pittsburgh. And he turned to one of his close advisors, Sam Rosenman, and said, Sam, in 1932, when I was in Pittsburgh, I promised them a balanced budget. What am I going to say? Rosenman looked at him and smiled and said, deny you were in Pittsburgh, Mr. President. So... Now, you know, with regard to fracking, she is going to have to find out a way either of denying that she was in Pittsburgh or, you know, saying, look, I've learned a lot since then, and I was just plain wrong. And, how that's going to go over with you know, the environmentalists who applauded her for endorsing every jot and tittle of the Green New Deal, I don't know. But if she doesn't do that, she's going to lose Pennsylvania. And if she doesn't win Pennsylvania, she's not going to be president.
Right. Okay. Linda, do you have any thoughts on how she compensates for her weaknesses before we turn to the possible VP picks?
Well, obviously, I do think she needs to have some sister soldier moments. And I did not see the ICE comments, but I will tell you, ICE is a deeply troubled agency. I mean, there have been ICE agents who have murdered people, engaged in rapes. There are lots of problems within ICE. So it's not the KKK, but it is a deeply troubled institution. I do think that in terms of the border, the numbers right now just don't bear out the Trump fantasies. We are down again to much lower numbers after the executive order was put into place. We're behind 2023, 2022, and way behind 2021. So I think there are ways around it, but I think she would be well advised to latch on to that compromise Senator Lankford bill and to try to, you know, fashion an argument, much as the Congressman Swosey, I guess is how you pronounce his name, who took the George Santos seat in New York, much as he talked about immigration and that issue. That would be one of the things she could do. The other issue where I think she's vulnerable is on the issue of reparations. She has been in favor of reparations for the descendants of former slaves. Ironically, she would not benefit.
She wouldn't qualify.
Because,
no,
well, she wouldn't qualify because her dad, while African-American and his family may have been enslaved at one point, they were from Jamaica. So she wouldn't qualify. But I mean, I think she does need to come out with some compassionate but hard-hitting policy points that differentiate her. And I absolutely agree with Bill. She's got to do a 180 on fracking.
Damon, one area where she is not vulnerable and where the Trump people have been just outright lying about the numbers is crime, where it is just, it's fantasy land. You know, they talk about a world where crime is out of control. It's skyrocketing when in fact crime has been going down. It reached a very high number compared with recent history, nothing compared to the 90s, but it did spike in the final year of Trump's administration during the pandemic, and it's been coming down ever since. And she, as a former prosecutor, has a really good story to tell on being, you know, tough on crime. So that's an area that arguably, you know, the world is ready now for Kamala the cop, right?
I certainly think so. I mean, I thought that in 2019 she should run as Kamala the cop, yeah. But of course that was an unusual moment where the Democratic left was maximally confident in itself, and you know, that's the story of how we got Joe Biden as the nominee in that cycle, because everybody else on those primary debate stages was in a competition to prove they were further left than the next person. Harris was very much in the center of all of that. I think her background as a prosecutor can be definitely one of her strengths. She can sound tough on crime while confidently citing a few selective statistics to prove the point you noted, Mona, that crime actually is down quite a lot. I wouldn't tell her to go very strong on how it spiked under Trump, because that was during the pandemic and everyone understands, like, the country as a whole on all sides went kind of bonkers that summer. But you can simply say crime actually peaked under Trump. It has been coming down since. We have overseen that in the Biden administration, and I will continue it because I believe it's important to protect all American citizens of every race, creed, and color from predators on the street. And she can also do what Matt Iglesias at his Substack has been pushing, which is a slight subtle difference in that is not just talk about crime as policy, but talk about police officers as human beings who you respect. These are people who go out there and risk their lives to keep us safe. And you can throw in lines along the way that acknowledge police brutality and excesses that need to be brought to heel, both to protect citizens from abuse, but also to protect the image of the good cops who vastly outnumber the bad cops. That kind of a message coming from a former prosecutor who is a woman of color and a Democrat, when Democrats frequently are hampered by the perception that they're somehow weak on crime, I think it'd be a very effective mix and neutralize a whole lot of stuff that the Republicans are going to be trying to throw their way. I certainly agree with everything Bill and Linda have said about her vulnerabilities over things like fracking and other public stances that she's taken earlier in her career. But the crime issue is one of those key issues where Democrats are sort of having to always run against their sort of subliminal associations in the minds of voters. You know, the kind of stuff like Republican, the daddy party, tough, the Democrats, mommy party, more compassionate. Each party typically wants to kind of cut against that a little bit in order to neutralize going too far in the direction that just confirms it. And I think she has a very good way of doing exactly that.
So I think also with the steering into the prosecutor is ways in which this election is distinctly different from past ones. So both you have, say, in comparison to Harris making the case against Trump versus compared to, say, Hillary making the case in 2016, that Hillary was arguing of he will do this or he could do that. And imagine, you know, this of him in office, whereas Harris has the ability to say he was in office and he has been convicted in court by a jury, you know, is a convicted criminal, has been found liable for sexual assault in a court of law, and has more of that on her side. And in comparison to 2020, where I was among the people who thought that she was a weak primary candidate in 2020 or that she disappointed. I guess I had higher expectations for her in 2020. But part of that was that her whole political persona was as the tough prosecutor, tough on crime prosecutor, and, you know, an attorney general, and then had been the one in the Senate to kind of prosecute Republicans in the Trump administration and make the case against them. And then with Democrats' distinctly anti-police mood, especially among the primary electorate, anti-police mood, she shied away from it. And so it reminds me of what I thought was one of the bigger cases of political malpractice of my life, but where in 2000, when Al Gore's team convinced him that no one really cares about climate change or environment, that stuff's boring, don't talk about it. And Gore largely avoided it. It's the topic he was most passionate about. And what was the line on him? He's inauthentic. He doesn't really care. He's not passionate. He's boring. And so whereas Harris was trying to dance around her main thing and try to avoid her main kind of selling points of her background, that now, especially given Trump's criminality, she can really steer into it. And in almost a Nixon to China way, she is in a position with Biden dropping out and with Trump being the alternative, a position that a lot of the, you know, Kamala is a cop left and want to oppose her, are largely going to hold their fire and are, you know, even if as more interested in doing like a French style, okay, everybody just forget it. We have to win this election, unite for now, and we'll work out our differences later. Even if something like that, that Biden was a pretty big hindrance for them doing that, and more of them seem on board now. So I expect her to do it a lot and think it'll be a big strength for her.
Popular front. All right. Let's talk about her VP pick. But first, let's have a word from Mint Mobile. With big wireless providers, what you see is never what you get. Somewhere between the store and your first month's bill, the price you thought you were paying magically skyrockets. With Mint Mobile, you'll never have to worry about gotchas ever again. When Mint Mobile says $15 a month when you purchase a three-month plan, they mean it. So you don't have to be shocked by, wait a minute, what's this extra expense or that extra charge? I don't recognize that. And that will not happen. Say goodbye to overpriced wireless plans, jaw-dropping monthly bills, and unexpected overages. Mint Mobile is here to rescue you with premium wireless plans starting at $15 a month. All plans come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. Use your own phone with any Mint Mobile plan and bring your phone number along with all your existing contacts. Ditch overpriced wireless with Mint Mobile's deal and get 3 months of premium wireless service for $15 a month. To get this new customer offer and your new 3 month premium wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/beg to differ. That's mintmobile.com/beg to differ. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/beg to differ. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3 month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details. And we thank them for sponsoring this podcast. Damon Linker, I'm going to start with you. Do you have a favorite in the VP sweepstakes?
Aha. Well, I happen to live in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, and we have a very good governor here. I wouldn't want to lose him. I mean, I guess if we were just asking Damon Linker, the voter, I would say Josh Shapiro, our governor here. But I understand that Josh Shapiro, as you can tell from the name, is Jewish, and he is also an outspoken defender of Israel. And that could create big problems for Kamala Harris with the left wing of the party, especially at the convention coming up in Chicago, where we still don't know if the anti-Israel protesters will be showing up and making a big mess in the street outside, let alone inside the convention hall. So I worry a little bit about what that could do for the very nice intra-democratic unity we've been seeing for the last, I don't know, half week. So that gives me a little pause. I guess I'll just say a word or two about a couple of others. I think Andy Beshear in Kentucky would be great, probably on policy. I like him as much as anybody. I think he's done pretty well on media this week. I don't think all of his appearances have gone perfectly, but I think he's shown that he's good at banter and taking partisan shots in a charming way. And he has shown, this is a selling point to everyone, he's shown that he's capable of winning as a Democrat who's a outspoken pro-choice guy in a red state of Kentucky. That shows some real skill that could prove very useful for the Harris campaign. Besides that, I mean, the others, I think, all have upsides or downsides. I'm very much as I love Gretchen Whitmer, I think the idea of Democrats running two women against Donald Trump is a real risk. I want to see just one woman get through that gauntlet before an all-woman ticket tries it. So my risk aversion leads me to shy away from her, much as I would be at least as happy with her at the top of the ticket as I am with Kamala Harris. But I don't want to, you know, stamp all the candidates.
That's fine.
So
that's
I'll good. I'll leave it there.
Yeah, that's good. Leave it there. Nick Grossman, how do you evaluate the whole, you mentioned earlier the problems with the Arab American voters in Michigan. How do you think a Josh Shapiro VP pick would affect her overall chances? I mean, on the one hand, Pennsylvania is a must-win state for Democrats, and Josh Shapiro is very popular. On the other, there is an issue because the Democratic Party has become distinctly unfriendly to Israel.
Yeah, so I was going to go with the Midwest governor answer also, just in the need to try to shore that up electorally, that those are the states that Democrats really need to win. And if they can win them, then probably win the presidency. The Shapiro thing gives me pause a bit, and then that gives me pause in turn, because the idea of, this would be the second Jewish American that's on a presidential ticket, you know, after Joe Lieberman is the vice presidential nominee under Al Gore. And the idea that, he won big in his state, but, you know, people are not going to totally like that part of it, or it's going to make them bring up Israel a lot more. And then we'll be on the where exactly is the line between anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism and all of that. And perhaps avoiding that might be for the best, though I don't love that idea. And that kind of makes me uncomfortable. And given how well he did in Pennsylvania, that maybe it's a non-issue and is mostly just would be throwing something to a group of protesters who would never vote for any Democrat anyway. Maybe some of them would, but not as much. So
yeah.
I guess then, if I would throw in another name, maybe North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper. Just in the sense of a governor who managed to win, a Democratic governor won statewide in a purple state, that it's been close in the presidential elections. If that puts it back in play, then good. I think the question of an all-woman ticket is interesting in that, it's kind of really going for it and making this the Dobbs election, where the women's rights, kind of women bodily autonomy election, that abortion has been a very strong issue for Democrats. It's done very well in things like referenda, winning referenda in Kansas or other states that people often think that it won't. So that's one that I think many are still underestimating as an issue of how much it's going to impact the election. But the one that I've heard mentioned that I'd be wary of is Pete Buttigieg. And not because, I've heard it said, not because of anything about, his ability to be on television, but just in the primary, whereas we did see Harris maybe have that issue of the cop persona that didn't work so well. But Pete Buttigieg proved to have a very narrow kind of strong constituency and not seem to reach out beyond it all that well. And so that for electoral purposes, would make me warier, though he's clearly smart.
Very smart. So, Linda, I think Kamala Harris is going to be able to get all the pro-abortion voters. She doesn't need help with that, I don't think. That's not going to be a weakness that needs shoring up. And regarding Roy Cooper, he's an impressive guy. He's a little older. Not a chance that I think it's very, very unlikely that Democrats are going to carry North Carolina this year. But it's possible they could get Arizona, which brings us to Mark Kelly. What do you think?
I don't know why I've never gotten enthusiastic about
maybe because he has no charisma.
Yeah, there's sort of, I don't know, something sort of dull about him. I'll tell you one thing. The gun issue could be made a much bigger issue because, of course, he's married to former Congressman Giffords, and she had the horrific attempt on her life on Ultra. And that's why Mark Kelly is, frankly, in the Senate, is because of that. And that would be a good thing. And it might make things go better, might, put the nail on the coffin of Carrie Lake's campaign, were he to be on the ticket and get more Democrats out. One person who's not talked about, and I guess it's probably because of age, is Tony Evers of Wisconsin, who's a popular governor there, but he is 72. I think that probably loses the advantage of the youthful. I'm for Josh. Shapiro, I think, is still a terrific candidate. And by the way, I think Kamala Harris is going to have a little bit of a pro-Israel problem, not because she's too pro-Israel, but because she's been critical. I was very pleased to see that she came out very quickly with a statement condemning some of the protesters who showed up during Bibi Netanyahu's speech.
Yep.
She said, anti-Semitism has no place and being pro-Hamas has no place, because those demonstrators actually spray painted, Hamas is coming. Right on the monument, the Columbus Monument, I will add, in front of the train station.
They also tore down the American flag and put up a Palestinian flag.
Yeah, yep. I mean, it was really awful. But I think that it's, I think she needs help with the Jewish community, despite having a Jewish husband. I think, you know, the Jewish community is not a huge voting bloc, but it has traditionally been Democrat. You want each and every registered Jewish Democrat to vote for the Democratic ticket if you want to help.
They are also strategically located in some of the suburbs of the major cities that are
some of the major cities,
like in Pennsylvania,
In places like Buck County in Pennsylvania. Yeah. So I, you know, I'm still pushing for Shapiro, and if it's not Shapiro, Andy Beshear is my number two choice. But nobody's asked me, frankly, except you, Mona.
Well, of course I would ask you. All right, Bill. So it's up to you to decide. Bill Galston gets to pick the vice president. Who's it going to be?
I don't know who it's going to be. I was talking to a Brookings group a couple of days ago, and you know, they were earnestly asking me for my punditry on the vice president. I said, look, you know, everybody in this room could go into an isolation booth and in 15 minutes come up with exactly the same short list.
Right.
We should also remember that these days, you know, unlike the old days when vice presidents were consigned to the outer darkness, these days, presidents and vice presidents work closely together. And so there is a chemistry issue that no one from the outside can assess. But a presidential nominee looking, you know, looking at a potential vice presidential selection will ask him, or in this case herself, well, do I really think that I can work well? Will we be a good team? Is this possibility someone that I'd really look forward to spending a lot of time with? And those intangibles, I suspect, will ultimately drive the choice among at least two entirely eligible candidates. I do agree that, you know, having picked one Jew as her husband, picking a second one as her running mate would put paid to the anti-Semitism suspicion pretty well.
You know, her stepchildren call her Mamala. That's their nickname for her.
And why not? Look, you know, I'm out of the prediction business. I do think that unless all things are very unequal, choosing someone who improves your chances of winning a swing state would be the better part of wisdom. You know, and clearly there are two out of the people we've discussed who have some real prospect of doing that, namely Shapiro and Mark Kelly. I think, you know, Beshear certainly not, you know,
right. Obviously,
you know, that would be the 40th state, you know, that Kamala would carry. And as for North Carolina, Mona, I'm inclined to agree with you because in a year 2020 in which Biden won nationally by 4.5, he lost North Carolina by 1.5. So he did 6 points worse in North Carolina than he did nationally. And I don't you could argue that because North Carolina has one of the largest African-American shares of the electorate in the entire country, that the combination of Cooper, you know, plus Harris's special appeal could put North Carolina in play. But compared to Pennsylvania, and Arizona, it's a real stretch. So, I would predict that it would come down in the end to Shapiro and Kelly, and that's where the chemistry issue will probably prove decisive.
Well, thank you. I would only like to just add my two cents, which is, in the end, I think it should come down to, these things are all important, bringing a swing state, very important, but also candidate quality. And Josh Shapiro happens to have it all. He is so solid. He is not the type to wilt under the harsh light of a of a national campaign. He seems to be sort of emotionally centered, in addition to very bright and a good speaker. And when it comes right down to it, as we've seen over the last number of weeks, as we've gone through the torture of having to watch Biden attempt to communicate and be so unsuccessful, being a politician is mostly about being a good talker. Mm-hmm. And it's sure. why Pete Buttigieg, you know, rocketed from the mayor of a small town to or medium-sized city to national prominence, because he's a good talker. And that's what you need. And you need good communicators. So that's why I think I lean toward Josh Shapiro, despite the problems in the Democratic Party about Israel and Gaza and all the rest of it.
Okay. By the way, I see online while we've been talking that there's a new left-wing group that is denouncing Genocide Josh.
Oh, great.
In their attempt to convince the Harris team that they don't want to go near that guy.
Yeah. You know what? That tells me that I think that will improve Shapiro's attractiveness.
Yeah, if so, that would be
a mistake.
Yeah, hopefully. All right. Yeah. Well, thank you all for that. Let us turn now to our highlights or lowlights of the week, and we'll start with our guest, Nicholas Grossman.
All right. So for mine, I've got a quick highlight and then also a low light, which are just both the two recent speeches. And that for me, the Biden farewell speech, which is I didn't totally pitch it that, but his kind of this is why I'm stepping down speech. I liked a lot. And so it was this sort of thing that wouldn't have really landed as a candidate speech, but as a kind of valedictory and a statesman going out. I liked it in that he tapped into a lot of for lack of a better term, kind of cheesy American patriot stuff. And I like that stuff too. And I think that the degree to which that both, you know, a number of people think it's kind of, I don't know, uncool. People who were with him also the Trump phenomenon about how negative he is about America, about how much he talks about how terrible this place is. And that I mean, think back to history, a lot of the sweeping political rhetoric of, you know, these great quotes from various presidents and from major American figures that I liked Biden tapping into that and these kind of bigger ideals. And it stirred me in a way that political speeches rarely do. But when they do, I think really, really lands. And then for me, the negative speech was Benjamin Netanyahu's address to Congress. And the reason why that was a low light for me was because even for, say, one who is sympathetic to his position, that he didn't really argue it, that he was mostly focused of very kind of removed and abstract of things, making the case of Israel has a right to exist and Iran is a aggressor in the region that the U.S. should oppose. And October 7th attack was very, very bad. And all of those, which, you know, I strongly agree with all three of those, but I think that probably many people do. And that the criticisms of Netanyahu, the concerns about his government's policies are about the way that obviously some people just, you know, hate Israel, just oppose Israel. But is about the conduct of the war and that things like, for example, his government's resistance to having a plan or even talking really about a plan for what happens next and how they try to set that up now and other things where the U.S. has been pushing them. And I thought he largely ducked that. And so that Netanyahu's legacy going back at this point, at least 10 years with the United States, has been pushing Israel from a bipartisan consensus issue in the U.S. to a partisan issue. And then during his tenure there, also tied himself a lot closer to Trump. And this kind of sealed that. And I think that that is terrible for Israel's long-term strategy. And that it's one of his biggest legacies of making pro-Israel now more of a Republican thing than an American thing.
I agree with that he made a mistake by, you know, allying himself with the right, both actually in Israel and in the United States, in both cases. Although I would just say, I'm sure you agree that the tendency on the left to become hostile to Israel is not entirely laid at the foot of Netanyahu. That's a broader phenomenon.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. There's some elements that have, you know, a kind of left-wing version of anti-Semitism that creep into it. A lot of it is longstanding hostility to the Israeli state and the idea of Zionism, the idea of a Jewish state that's going on for a while. There are elements of kind of anti-Americanism, anti-Westernism that creep into it. So absolutely, that's sort of been running for a while. And that, if anything, that would mean something where an Israeli prime minister for a long-term strategy for its very crucial partnership with the United States would then be looking to isolate that and trying to keep the Democratic center away from it, as opposed to saying to try to push them more towards it and being like, well, if you don't vote Republican, then I don't actually want your support.
100%. Couldn't agree more. Damon Linker.
Well, I'm going to make a low light, something that it was kind of a collective meltdown that was visible on Twitter/X early this week in the wake of Biden announcing that he was stepping down and endorsing Kamala Harris shortly after that. First on Monday, there was a kind of upsurge of fairly prominent right-of-center writers, many of them affiliated with National Review, who kind of got themselves whipped into a frenzy about where's Joe? Like, Joe stepped down from the presidency in this weird memo that got released on social media, but he didn't actually speak to the press. And then a couple of days went by and he still wasn't there. And so started asking, you know, is he really ill? Is he dead? You had people speculating about, wait, I thought I heard sirens. He's being moved to Air Force One and taking off. It was like watching a right-wing conspiracy take root in real time, in public, among people you would like to think, even 8 years into the Trump era, would have a little bit more restraint and a kind of intellectual discipline than to get swept up in this in public. And then the next day, on Tuesday, you had another wave of this that was another issue. This had to do with a month or two ago, every Democrat was saying, Joe is fine. This is a conspiracy if you think that he's too old. And then the debate happened and suddenly everyone said that Joe was senile and couldn't be president for another second. But we can't go to Kamala because she's terrible. And then Kamala becomes the nominee and suddenly everybody is saying she's wonderful and great and portraying this as a kind of collective psychosis among Democrats, as if the whole party was in the grip of a kind of mania where it flips from 180 degrees to the other back and forth in the matter of a week. And again, my response to seeing these people suggest this as a real theory was just to say, what are you talking about? Like, most Democrats liked Biden. Most Democrats still like Biden. Most Democrats liked Harris before. Most of them still like Harris. They got very nervous when he did badly at the debate. So they got scared that they might lose to this man they all don't like at all, Donald Trump. And then when Harris became the nominee, they said, yay, a young person who can speak and make arguments and actually make the case to defeat the guy we've always disliked. This is all perfectly like normal behavior. And yet the right, I think, was so shaken by losing Biden as an opponent that they became convinced, again, in real time in public, that really kind of crazy psychotic behavior was going on when it was really perfectly normal. And that just makes me wonder, like, what is happening to our public life? Like, what is it possible for any pundit to kind of keep their equilibrium through a period of some turbulence and not lose their heads? And I really don't know.
Yep, Damon. It's just, I think you're saying there's very little sanity out there at the moment.
That's for sure. And of course, on the left, we had people saying some crazy stuff about how the assassination attempt on Trump was all a kind of conspiracy and it was staged. So,
right.
It was staged. It's not just the right. It's just that this week it was more on the right.
Yeah. Yeah. Linda.
Well, before I get to my highlight, I have to beg to differ with a couple of you on the Bibi Netanyahu speech. I am no longer a fan of Bibi Netanyahu. I think he bears enormous responsibility for the failures on October 7th and what happened to Israel. However, I thought it was a very good speech. And the thing I liked most about it was his showing the diversity of Israel. As somebody who's just back from Israel a couple of weeks ago, it is one of the things that impresses you. Israel is a very diverse country. There are Arabs, there are Ethiopian Jews, And obviously both Sephardic and Ashkenazi Jews. And so I really liked his showcasing that. And I thought it was a very good speech. Now to my highlight. My highlight actually is a little bit of a throwback. It's about a week old, but it's on YouTube now. And that is a fireside chat between Condoleezza Rice and Robert Gates at the Aspen Security Forum. It was a really smart discussion of the perils of the world today by two people who I think have great depth and did a wonderful analysis. Condoleezza Rice said this is not a new Cold War that we're experiencing now. She compared what's happening now to the interwar period between World War I and World War II. She talked about the rise of populism, nativism, protectionism, and isolationism, all of which helped lead to World War II, and talked about how those are now very popular now. And Bob Gates talked about China in depth. There was even a discussion of whether or not the decision to let China into the World Trading Organization, become a member of the G7, whether that was a good idea or not, and an analysis of why it was a good idea, but it's gone bad under Xi. But I thought it was a really good discussion, worth the 30 or so minutes to hear two smart conservatives talk about foreign policy, something we will not see if Donald Trump is elected.
Or possibly even if Kamala Harris is elected.
Yeah, but at least there's a hope that maybe the Republican Party will reconstitute itself. I keep hoping for this for years.
Okay, well, we can hope. Bill Galston.
I have two highlights breaking my streak.
Yeah.
Number one, addressing one of the questions du jour, Edward Isaac Dovere has a very long and well-informed and balanced analysis of Kamala Harris and the choices that she faces on Mideast policy and particularly Gaza. And, I do recommend it. It's on CNN. He just updated it a couple of hours ago. The second highlight, I'm leaving on vacation tomorrow, which means that for next week and the 2 weeks thereafter, I will be joining this esteemed company from Cape Cod, where I am desperately hoping for temperate weather. So I'm not taking a vacation from Beg to Differ, but I am taking a vacation from the dismal swamp that Washington always is metaphorically, but through July especially, has been literally with a series of 100-degree-plus temperatures with humidity to match. That will reduce a grown man to tears inside of 10 minutes on the sidewalk.
Well, have a great time in Cape Cod. I should add that I will be away next week. I am going up to Chautauqua, New York, to give a couple of speeches. So I will be away, and A.B. Stoddard will be sitting in for me.
Just don't get stabbed.
Yeah, well, that is exactly what happened, yes, to Salman. That's where Salman Rushdie was attacked at the Chautauqua Festival. So, yep, that's where I'm going. It should be cooler weather up there as well. So, and then we're going to spend some time in Canada. So I'm looking forward to that. And I want to highlight, I also have a highlight. So I don't know if we had any lowlights this week, but I want to praise some good writing in the New York Times this week. I see a lot that I don't like in major prestigious publications these days. I mean, they've had to cut way back on editing, and there are a lot of grammatical errors there didn't used to be. There's a lot of word usage that's wrong. There's a lot of punctuation that's wrong, and it drives me crazy. But I have to say that this was really nice writing, and so I'm going to give a tip of the old hat to a reporter named Andrew Kay, K-E-H, writing in the New York Times. He was writing about the Olympics, soon to open in Paris, he was writing about the shooters. And he said, quote, Olympic shooters have time-tested mental exercises they use to get through some of the most stressful moments of their careers. They exhale deeply to steady their nerves. They assess the targets ahead of them. They trust in the preparation that got them there. Then, finally, they're ready to check in at the airport. And he goes on to describe the challenges of taking all of these weapons on an airplane. Anyway, I thought that was lovely. Nice work, New York Times. And I would just also quickly mention that Reason Magazine had a very good piece about the crime rate in the United States and the misrepresentations of it from top to bottom, from murder to every other crime. The one crime that has not drifted downwards during the Biden administration is carjacking, you know, and then there are certain like local regional variations. But in general, crime has been coming down. That story has got to be told because it is just it's just infuriating that something like 77% of the American people tell pollsters they think crime is going up and it isn't. All right. With that, I want to thank Nicholas Grossman and my regular panel, also our producer, Jim Swift, and our wonderful viewers and listeners. And Beg to Differ will be back next week, as every week. Thank you.